Okay, so the date is the 10th of June, 2015. My name is Clara Manassian-Cook, and I'm here in 32 Lincoln's Inn, LSE, and I'm interviewing Simeon Underwood. Simeon, please can you tell me, state your full name and your date of birth?
My name is Simeon Underwood. I was born on 27 December 1954.
Please can you tell me what's your job title here at LSE?
My current job title is Academic Registrar and Director of Academic Services. When I first came to the LSE, starting on the 1st of August 2000, I came as an Assistant Registrar with a particular role in relation to quality assurance and the school's relation with a body called the Quality Assurance Agency. In 2005, I was promoted to become Academic Registrar, and in about 5 weeks' time, I will be retiring. I've worked in the British higher education sector for 38 years, since the 1st of February 1977. I started out as a very junior administrator at the University of Leeds, where I was working directly to one Christine Challis, who later spent many years here at the LSE as the school's secretary. I moved to York University in 1980, spent 15 years there. I then spent 5 years at Lancaster, doing, in effect, a lot of consultancy work around the sector in relation to quality assurance before I came to the LSE.
And what was your first impressions of LSE when you first arrived?
When I first arrived, it was clearly very different from those other places I had worked, in about three or four different ways. Firstly, it was geographically very much smaller. Its footprint in 2000 was much smaller than it is now, 15 years later. It was a university which went up and down with lifts and tall buildings, compared to other universities I've worked at, and it had very little sense of space, and in particular no sense of green space. So it was very crowded. A second impression was that the students were completely different to anywhere else I'd worked. They were massively motivated to what they were here for. They were clearly argumentative. You came across them in the lifts on Houghton Street, arguing with one another in many different languages, and usually the arguments were intense. And what also struck me very early on, and has remained with me as an impression, is that they were always arguing about what they were learning. They were arguing about the subject of the lectures they'd just seen, the seminars they'd been to. They weren't talking about football or television. They were actually engaging with the subject matter. The third impression, slightly more negative in a way, is that the LSE seemed to me to be old-fashioned in certain senses. It still had a very strong sense of academic hierarchy, in which administrators were very much almost a servant class. And I'm not sure that in the 15 years I've been here, that's actually gone away. Many of its approaches to teaching were old-fashioned, and still are. We have an amazingly, in my view, over-heavy emphasis on closed examinations, with students taking 2 to 3 hour examinations as the main method of assessment on their courses and programmes. And this was something that other universities, it seemed to me, had moved on from a while back. Similarly, I found myself having argument with academic staff around issues which many other universities had moved on from, notably the attitude towards the Quality Assurance Agency, or the attitude towards what a PhD is and why the submission rates of PhD students should matter.
And out of all of these things, what did you find the most challenging when you first arrived here, coming from your previous background?
For me professionally, the most challenging was undoubtedly the third, the issue of engagement between myself as an administrator, a senior administrator with a great deal of experience in the sector and a particular political brief, and an academic community which was quite introspective and verging at times on being arrogant. I think that's died back a little bit, but it still manifests itself from time to time. I attend discussions at the academic board where I hear some fairly almost fundamentalist beliefs about higher education being expressed, and I think I have a worry here that we are attracting an extremely high calibre of students and possibly not giving them the support, the attention that they warrant. There is, I think, an element where the research intensiveness of the LSE, the priority to research and public engagement via research, has taken priority over concern for students both collectively and individually.
Do you think that is a problem in general with high-profile universities in London?
Yes, I think you're right there, that most British research-intensive universities face a significant dilemma in a way that they didn't when I started in the sector in the 70s and early 80s. The prizes for research through the research assessment exercise and the research excellence framework, and those are prizes both of money and reputation, have in my view profoundly distorted behaviour. I don't think I'm saying that the LSE is significantly out of line here in its attitude to students from other top-flight British universities. I do think, though, it is a particular problem given the calibre of the students we take, given that about 50% of the students we take are postgraduate and therefore have had experience of another university first, and given also the multinationalism of our student body.
And what is your what's your opinion about the staff at LSE? Do you feel that do you feel there's a difference in the administration at LSE compared to the administration of, for instance, the other places that you worked at, such as Lancaster, Leeds and York?
I think the administrative staff at the LSE are very much in line with colleagues I've worked with at other British universities. I suspect sometimes people outside the sector, or even other people inside the sector, don't fully appreciate just how loyal and hardworking many administrators are. And this applies both to administrators in the central services, areas like the academic registry or other central divisions, as we call them at the moment, and the administrative staff who work in academic departments. There are issues at the moment about a feeling of respect. There is an issue around reward for this category of staff, especially in a context where recently both academic and research staff have had their career structure completely revised and, in a sense, re-incentivized. There are issues about representation. Many of these people are among the institution's most loyal and most engaged staff, and yet they are not represented to any extent whatever within the governance structure. And I think there's also an issue around the impact of change, which comes primarily on these staff. And quite often, the staff, whether central or in departments, find themselves as a kind of buffer zone between the wish of governing bodies, including council and sometimes the academic board, for change, and the apparent wish of some academic staff, some academic departments, to resist change. And the brokering of this, the attempt to translate what the school as an entity wants into what academic departments can cope with, is very much what administrative staff face up to on a daily basis. And that, I would say, seems to me to be more pronounced here than at other British universities. It is striking to an outsider, particularly somebody who's worked at other universities, that the governance structure of the LSE is very flat. There is a central administration, a central management of the school around the director, which, in spite of what many academic staff think, is very small compared to many other British universities. And there are then there's then nothing between that and 23, 25 academic departments all in a straight line. So there is a bizarre situation where the director or the provost is line manager to all the heads of department. In most other British universities, that would be handled by a pyramidical faculty structure, which doesn't happen here. And I think that creates the situations where departments can operate semi-autonomously, semi-independently from what the school is doing and also what the school wants to do.
Why do you think that is so? Like, why do you think that structure is in place at LSE?
Because the LSE has never aggregated departments together in a particularly effective way. The only example of that within my time at the LSE was the creation of the Department of Management out of four component units in about 2007, 2008. I also think it's historical, and I also think that a particular factor here is the role of the LSE's academic board, which, unlike the Senate's that most British universities have, is not a representative body, but an inclusive body on which all members of the academic staff and most members of the research staff can actually serve on an equal footing. So if the academic board ever met with full membership, there would be about 900 people there. In practice, there are usually only about 60 to 80. But even so, it becomes a body which is representative of local and often very small interests, as it were, blocking change that doesn't suit them, rather than a body that is trying to shape the school.
And thinking about your position in the school and your department, how is this way that the structure, how's the structure, the LSE's management structure, affected your ability to make changes in your job?
Okay, let me say a bit about what my division actually does, because the title Academic Registrar is not entirely clear to people outside the sector or even people within it. Howard Davis always used to feign not to understand what the term meant. I'm in charge of a range of student-facing administrative services, covering widening participation, recruitment, admissions, student financial support, registration, timetabling, exams, degree classification, post-graduation certification, teaching quality assurance. All of those come within my patch, and I've got about 90 staff working to me who deliver these various functions. In a sense, we are the engine room on the student side of the school. If we got things wrong, the consequences would be immensely serious. So if we didn't admit enough students, if we botched the exam season, even if on every one of, you know, think about us issuing over 7,000 degree certificates every year, if we got a student's classification wrong on one of them. So the consequences of what we do are profound. And my role as registrar over the last 10 years has been to work with the school's senior management, both with the people in the directorate, pro-directors like Janet Hartley and Paul Kelly and Ray Richardson, and also with the committee structure, to try to make sure that whatever changes are required of us make sense and are feasible and are practicable and aren't going to damage delivery of those fundamental functions. And so that's what I spend a lot of my time doing, which is listening to people's ideas, working out whether we can turn them into practice and how, working out what the cost of that is. No British university is actually very good at working out prospectively the costs of management and administrative change. And then ensuring that the implementation is actually monitored so that we can be sure that it's happening and is delivering what is intended of it.
And over the years of you being in this position, what do you feel are your biggest triumphs? What are you most satisfied with when you look back?
Okay, I've got three particular things I want to talk about there. Firstly, when I've started here in the job in teaching quality assurance, at that stage the LSE was at loggerheads with the Quality Assurance Agency. Famously, in March 2001, it voted to secede from the QAA, even though it wasn't actually in a formal position where it could secede. In a sense, it was a big symbolic vote. I think it was something like 76-4 at a meeting of the academic board. There was a lot of media coverage about it at the time. And my role in those first two or three years, and I do regard this as a significant success, was partly to stop the LSE and the QAA doing any damage to one another, so the LSE going very public, viral to use a term we would not have used in 2001, could conceivably have done damage to what the QAA was doing. Equally, an adverse judgment from the QAA along the way could have actually done damage to the school. So I managed to arrange a situation whereby people like Judith Rees and Steve Hill took the lead in persuading the QAA to hold off on a process called institutional audit until I felt we were ready for this. And in getting us ready, I've been working on the principle of trying to create the condition where if we want to make changes in terms of our quality assurance arrangements, we do so on our own initiative and on our own terms, rather than by actually following prescriptions from the QAA. If there is a way... No, I'll stop that sentence there. The second great achievement came between about 2004 and 2008. Although the University of London is still there, although Senate House still dominates that part of the London landscape, its role in our life is very much smaller than it used to be. And in that period, initially with the support of my predecessor as academic registrar, George Kylo, and then on my own initiative, we did a lot of work to disentangle ourselves from the academic side of the university. There were two stages to this. At the time, the university still formally conducted research degree examinations. It still formally awarded the PhD degrees at the LSE, and it still handled the PhD appeals. So the first step was actually to create the situation where we ran those for ourselves as an independent exercise. We'd already been running exams for undergraduate and taught postgraduate degrees since about the mid-1990s. But the last, as it were, stone in the wall was PhD degrees, which we took over around about 2005. And at that time, we made a special point of creating a special research degrees unit to look after PhD students independently. We then sought degree awarding powers through a complicated process run by the QAA. That was administratively quite taxing, quite sustained. The QAA, one suspects, did not like our approach to governance, but at the same time, for the QAA to refuse to give the LSE degree awarding powers would have been really very shocking in political terms. So we got it. And having initially got it on the basis that we would get the degree awarding powers and put it in a drawer until the future of the University of London became clearer, we then, along with King's, UCL and the Institute of Education, took the view that we wanted to exercise our own degree awarding powers while staying within the university, Now, in constitutional terms, that's all fascinating stuff, the kind that administrators cut their teeth on. So we spent a couple of years negotiating that, and in about 2007 or 2008, we awarded our very first own LSE degrees. As a footnote, where in many other universities the process of designing gowns and degree certificates was the stuff of committees and long arguments, Howard Davis and I designed these between us. So that's achievement number two, the lessening of the influence of the University of London. And the university now reminds me of Byzantium in its later days. It's a sort of shell organisation, a bit of a husk, and no doubt one day the Turks will take it over. We stay in it simply, I think, because of our connection to it through the University of London international programmes. And I suspect if we were not so heavily engaged in that arm of activity, we would probably follow Imperial College in actually seceding from the university altogether. The third great claim I would make is assimilating into the university's administrative structure the very sudden growth of activity around student visas, which came onto the radar in a very big way between 2008 and 2011. Now, at the time, I was chair of a national body called the Academic Registrars Council, and for 2 years I spent a lot of time in direct discussion with senior officers in the Home Office, the UK Border Agency, as it was then, trying to work out what the new requirements on visas actually meant for the higher education sector, for universities, and also for the LSE. This was interesting stuff, in part because the LSE status gives it a certain clout, a certain fear factor in government, which I suspect most other universities don't have. It was grueling. The Home Office was a very difficult body to negotiate with. It was operating in response to often hasty ministerial decisions and directives. It hadn't really thought through the technology to support the system. It hadn't thought through the risks to higher education that the proposed new student visa system could bring with it. And I was very much at the front line there in talking to the Home Office and trying to bring this into play in a way that was met government aims without imposing undue bureaucracy on universities. And there were various tensions here. A number of academic staff, both at the LSE and elsewhere, actually regarded this as almost treasonous, almost treacherous, actually dealing with the government on student visas. We should have resisted the whole thing. We should not have gone along with it. Almost appeasement. And I had some very difficult conversations with academic staff around that. At the same time, I was trying to put systems in place within the LSE to absorb all this, against a context where many other universities were making this a special area of activity, whereas the line that I wanted to take within the LSE was that it was very much assimilated into the activity of a number of the offices within my division, on the grounds that in due course there might be a steady state, in which case we could deal with it without having to dismantle the specialised apparatus we had put up. So that dominated my life, I think, between about 2008 and 2012. The steady state has arrived. It's not, neither the QAA nor the whole visa issue are on my desk in anything like the way they were at their key periods. Can I throw in a fourth achievement, having said I only wanted to talk about three? As a personal value system, I have been very keen to look after succession management. And I am now supported by a cadre of deputies, Kath Baldwin, Hannah Bannister, Mike Page, Simon Beattie, and Mark Thompson, who has recently been appointed to my job as my successor. And one of the most striking things about employment patterns over my working life is how they have changed from the expectation of a slow-moving career with two or three significant moves. I think in my career I've made perhaps four significant moves in 38 years. To a world where people now do not stay in jobs in the first 10 to 15 years of their life in anything more than 18 months, 2 years. They're constantly on the lookout for moving forward. And so this fourth achievement that I actually am particularly proud of is that I have kept these people at the LSE. I have slowed down their wanderlust. I have persuaded them that this is actually a good place to work where they can make a difference. And I hope then I'm leaving the school in 5 weeks' time with this area with a clear future sorted out for it.
Have you enjoyed working at LSE?
Yes, much of the time, no, some of the time. Let me talk about the no's first. I'm not naturally attracted to London. I particularly dislike even the 45 minutes each way commute I do. I know that's not long by some standards, but I just don't like it. I find London noisy, crowded, increasingly dirty, endless building works. So I'm not a natural Londoner. My workload has been high. I have had to compromise a bit on the work-life balance. That's one of the reasons I'm retiring early, in a sense to give my wife a sense of almost making up for that, condoning for it, quality time in return. And some of the business that I've been talking about, whether dealing with academic difficulties, academic conservatism, dealing with odd outside agendas, the difficulties of government influence on higher education, has not been enjoyable. On the more positive side, this does remain a very exceptional place. What makes it exceptional is the students and the feeling of running the important processes, and in particular, problem solving in creative ways that actually help good students to get better, to get through the very demanding academic environment of the LSE, is something that I think is very much positive, very much an enjoyable bit. I've contributed to the school beyond just running the ARD. I was chair of the senior common room for 3 years. So it has been a pleasant environment to work in. I'm not saying that it has been sort of kind of life-consumingly wonderful job that some people get, but I wouldn't have stuck it for 15 years if I hadn't been reasonably happy with what was happening.
Has there been any changes in the demographic of the individuals who work at LSE in the last 15 years?
I don't think there's been a significant change in, if you like, the demographic of administrative staff. I think there is a growing pressure on the school, and be provocative for a moment, I would say the school hasn't responded as in as agile a way as it should have around gender and ethnicity. Among academic staff, it seems to me probable, though I've never seen any figures, that a higher proportion of our academic staff are from overseas. I think the gap between academic and administrative staff still exists, that's probably not as pronounced as it used to be, and the number of seriously difficult academic staff to deal with has come down. And I think those are the kinds of changes, if that's what you were asking about and talking about demographic.
How has the physical campus changed? I mean, have you...
Out of all recognition. When I came here in 2000, The library was still being revamped, so it was off on that funny building it had off Chancery Lane. And Portugal Street was in effect the more or less the north boundary, apart from one or two sort of odd bits and pieces. Now, of course, we have 32 Lincolns in Field where we are at the moment. We're about to get 44 Lincolns in Field. We're about to get we've got the new academic building, the new student centre. We're working on the centre buildings. We're going to close Houghton Street. But by the time the centre buildings and 44 LIF are done, by, say, 2021 or thereabouts, the school will have, for the first time in its history, a complete suite of purpose-built, high-quality, architecturally attractive buildings. Now, let me put in, though, a personal caveat there. I have a personal view that good teaching can happen in most situations, and you don't have to have glamorous buildings, actually, to do the good teaching. The glamorous buildings are, in part, I think, dictated by our perception of ourselves and our wish to compete with other world-leading universities. I think it's desperately important that in building the new buildings, we should ensure that they have soul. That's certainly the case with the student centre. I think it's important for us to keep that in mind. Otherwise, we risk becoming an architectural catalogue rather than a student-led study environment.
Do you feel that LSE is still true to its founding principles and values in line of the 120th anniversary?
Yeah. Well, I think you can dispute what those founding values were. There is a notion that, in effect, the socialist Fabians who founded us envisaged a fundamentally socialist institution. But I'm not sure that's entirely true. It is striking, if you look back in the calendars before the Second World War, the sheer variety of kinds of teaching that was going on, the balance between normal degree programmes but also evening classes, certificate courses for trade unionists, railway workers. The levels of which were often fairly basic. In Pygmalion, there is an after chapter by Shaw in which he tells the further story of Eliza Doolittle once she's married Freddie Eynsford Hill. And this includes doing an introductory book in introductory course in bookkeeping and accountancy at the LSE. And we don't do those now, certainly not for florists off the street. And I think that our initial principles, the things that we were initially set up to do, have, if you like, been modulated by changes in the sense of what a university is. I've not looked back in the early materials, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Founding Fathers used the word university very sparingly. And it does seem to me important that we have kept the S in LSE. So I'm not sure we're entirely consistent to what the Webbs and the others at the time, Graham Wallis, actually had in mind when they set it up. In some ways, that's because the notion of education has changed, though, rather more than because we've changed.
And in your opinion, what do you think the future of LSE might look like?
I don't know, and I'm leaving, in a sense, at a very interesting time. This ties back to what I was just saying about the building work. In theory, 44 Lincolns in Field will give us a very sizable amount of floor space. So we are faced with issues around, do we expand student numbers to fill the space we have got? We could, for example, increase student numbers from the existing level of about 10,000 by another 2,000. But if we do that, Do we risk changing the shape of the LSE, turning it into a kind of learning factory? Because many of the students we would take to create those extra 2,000 would be in subjects like accounting, finance, law, economics, rather than in the broader social sciences, the non-vocational, non-professional social sciences, which in a sense are also an integral part of the LSE's character. If we don't add 2,000 students, how then do we afford what we are doing with 44 Lincoln's Inn Field and the Centre buildings? Another answer might be to sell off things like St Clement's or the Tower and create some funding out of that. We've got some fundamental questions about size and overall shape, and I think almost overall purpose of the school. And coupled to that, I think there's a second set of questions about almost wither the social sciences. We have a claim, I sometimes think it's a bit spurious, but we have a claim to have invented several of the key social sciences. But subjects can come and go. In my spare time, I'm a closet classicist, and there have been spells when classics has been on the point of dying, and then it's reinvented itself. So how do we reinvent some of the more moribund disciplines? Are there other disciplines out there which are genuine disciplines, which are not just, as it were, research creations, but are actually things that students want to do? So we're at a point where we have to do some serious futurology. And in the 15 years I've been here, mostly our horizon has been 3 to 5 years. How to ensure that we stay afloat, keep going, get the students in, bit of expansion here, bit of expansion there. We've been constrained largely by the estate, in part by the pressures of teaching against research, in part by our own governance systems and their inherent conservatism. We've now got some really big choices, which are about what the LSE will look like, not so much in 120 years, but in 150 years after it starts. So I think there are some really big questions about where we go over the next 30 years. Personally, this is not just about the LSE, this is my general view of higher education institutions in the UK. I think universities have outgrown themselves. When I started at York in 1980, it had 3,500 students. It's now got 15,000 students. And in that sense, again from the student point of view, there is a risk that the student loses identity within and with the institution. My own argument, if I was staying, though I suspect I'd be in the minority, would be for a future which actually continued to sustain the LSE as a niche institution with a limited number of students. I'd even be looking into planning scenarios based on reducing the number of students we've got at the moment. And that would be the kind of institution I would be looking to create. I don't know that others will think in those terms. There is the inevitable pull, once you've got space, once you look at your accounts, of trying to generate more money through additional students. But the world has changed significantly with the shift from government funding through to student-paid tuition fees. And I think that ought to be fundamental to our thinking.
And how does executive education fit in with all of this, LSE? So you mentioned that social sciences, there might be a problem with social sciences, or certain subjects waning because people are looking for degrees that help them with their employment. How does executive education fit in with us? Because they're very different students.
They're very different students with very different expectations. I personally, this is not an official view, this is not what other members of DMT think, I personally think that executive education is not going to provide us over the next 30 years with a steady stream of high-calibre students for whom we can put on high-calibre education. I really think that this is an area where we have to expect programmes to die. The undergraduate laws and economics degrees are never going to die. They're always going to get the endless numbers of students into the future. But executive education will have a short shelf life, and we will need to be constantly developing. And on a management perspective, the constant development carries with it constant development costs. So I don't see executive education as necessarily a major strand into the future. What I do see as a potentially major strand, we run very successful summer schools, very high caliber. The money that we get from summer schools and the University of London international programmes, which I mentioned earlier, have often been not far off the equivalent of our annual surplus. I think summer schools has the potential to grow. We've made a very significant change over the past year to the structure of the academic year. Hitherto, the pattern has been three terms of 10 weeks each, with the summer term in effect and exam season. We're moving to, I think it's 11-12-7. And that opens up all sorts of possibilities. So with a bigger estate, with greater flexibility in our notional calendar, then we may be able to develop our education portfolio in some more imaginative ways than just putting on stream more degree programmes of the existing sort.
So, in light of everything that you just said, mm-hmm. Before we finish, is there anything that you feel that we haven't covered that you want to speak about, or anything like the social element of working at LSE, like the SDR? Or
I think I'd like to say, as an administrator, I've always been conscious, whether elsewhere or here, of the need to earn academic respect. That is the way that administrators have to survive. You can lose that respect quite easily, but if you don't have it in the first place, you're never going to get anywhere. I've been struck by the number of people I've worked with at the school. Having said a fair amount about academic conservatism and even difficult academics, I've been struck by the number of people with whom it has been possible to set up profound, respectful relations. So people like Nicholas Sims, Howard Davis himself, Ray Richardson, Janet Hartley, both when she was vice chair of the academic board and as pro-director. And so on. There's numerous people, both at that kind of very high level, but also within academic departments. And I guess, thinking back on what I've said to you, my nervousness will be that I might come across as a grumpy administrator. I found it possible within the LSE to actually work with respect in ways that have been professionally fulfilling and also, I think, have helped the school to develop.